My guest today is perhaps the most widely renowned artist in the Columbia Pacific region. Royal Nebeker's work is shown internationally and is in many collections and museums. Nebeker lives in Gearhart. He has been chairman of the Clatsop Community College Arts Department. He began painting in this region well prior to the explosion in the number of galleries and artists who reside here. Royal, it's great to have you on the microphone today.
It's good to be here.
I'd like to take a stab at describing the origins of your work and have you help the listener see it. This is what one gallery owner told me. Nebeker's work is more influenced by the 20th century artwork that emanated from Northern Europe than anywhere else. Very few things he has done are influenced by American work in the second half of this century. Prominent influences are German Expressionism, work of Norwegians, especially Edvard Munch, and his Northern European Expressionism. How would you describe
it? I think
your work?
That nails it pretty good.
Okay.
Austrian succession school like Nolde and Klimt and Schiele. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, in Europe, they say my work is very American. And over here, I'm always identified as having those European connections.
Yeah. Let's talk for a minute about a remarkable event that happened here about a month ago, which is to say Hank Pander's shows at the college gallery and
right
down at the Maritime Museum. That was the last time I think you and I saw each other. How did those events in the turnout and the excitement around them, how did they compare with other events you've seen in this town?
Well, you know, it was definitely one of the highlights of our season up at the college at the Art Center Gallery. And I think the community responded very well to Hank's work. I thought it was really heartwarming that he connected so much to our community, that he came in the fall knowing that he was going to have the exhibition and did a large, not only a large number, but large watercolors that everybody saw in the show, mm-hmm, of our area and
yeah,
on location. I guess he had a trailer and he went out to different places and painted all day, and those were knockouts. They were really beautiful. So he connects really firmly to the spirit of Astoria, and he has done for some time. You know, this isn't the first time he's had
that
a show here. So.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. To the casual observer, I think the casual observer, such as myself, would just call his work dark. How would you elucidate Pander's art?
Well, we know, of course, that Hank is European-trained in Holland, and he certainly has those same roots that I do. I think that is kind of a common, maybe error in perception, if I could say that. Yes, it's dark, but it's only the optimists that paint that way, because a true optimist, and I'm talking about visual arts right now, is a person who can handle the dark side of life. And in some way, I mean, certainly when you look at those watercolors he did of Astoria, you couldn't call them dark. They were stunningly beautiful, seductive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in some way, I think what lends to a profound strength and a foundation to an artist's career is a willingness to look at all parts of life and not to gloss over. So art becomes very thin and very Disneyland-ish, you know, very very fantasy, nothing wrong with fantasy, but very limited to fantasy when it doesn't address issues of reality. And
yeah,
I mean, you could look at people like, speaking of the Expressionists, people like Van Gogh, Edvard Munch. You know, Edvard Munch, in the later half of his life, after those disturbing, the scream kind of images, painted these beautiful pastoral landscapes.
Right, yes. Yeah,
and also, yeah, who doesn't know, in as well as the tough Van Gogh's, his a field of sunflowers, you know. So I don't think it limits the beauty.
Sure. The Pander Show was in a way, an extension of what you started decades ago while you were running Clatsop College's art department. You brought in artists from across the country. What was your intention and how was that received?
Well, I really, you know, always associated that. That was how I was trained in Europe. You know, bringing artists in for the students to connect and see what it's all about and see what it would be to be an artist. And so we needed that kind of stimulus, I felt, for our students and for the community. And at first, there was a lot of resistance, especially from the local artists, because they felt like, what are you doing, you know, upstaging us with these folks from San Francisco and Seattle. And but I after a while, feel that the community really supported it, and it really helped our community, not only because we met these professional artists, but they took news of our art scene here back home, and it helped put us on the map.
Who were some of those artists you brought in?
Boy, you know, there was a huge list. I remember I had Michael Spafford, major artist from Seattle, and Faye Jones, Sweet Carnois from down the Bay Area. We had Christopher Brown, major painter from the Bay Area. We brought in John Bergruen, who's arguably the most important gallerist on the West Coast, and he lectured to the artists about the gallery situation. Rick Bartow's been here a few times, Lillian Pitt, and Joe Feddersen, who was here just a couple of years ago, and he's having a show now down at the Hallie Ford Museum, a wonderful artist. George Johansson, and a lot of other faculty members from the Museum Art School and Pacific Northwest College of Art in Portland.
Okay.
I guess one of our greatest honors is that we had Robert Adams, our local
photographer.
Yeah. We had a show for him, and I would say that was a major.
And that was before he moved here?
No, I think it was after he came.
After he came here,
yeah. It was very generous of him to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is After Deadline. I'm Steve Forrester. My guest is Royal Nebaker, an artist, resides in Gearhart. Royal, Clatsop College's arts program seems extensive. Quite extensive for a community college. How does it compare with what you'd find at another community college?
Well, you know, in the 90s, when I got a sabbatical, one of my objectives was to visit other community colleges in the Northwest, and just to kind of make that measurement and see how we were doing. And boy, we came out very, very well. I often joke with some of the students that we're the only community college with a graduate school. We hold on, you know, because of our geographic isolation, we hold on to some students that really belong in a graduate program somewhere.
Sure.
And but training artists is what it's about, and I think we do that very, very well. I think the gallery and the visiting artist program is a huge piece of that. But also look at our faculty. I mean, we've got a world-class potter with Richard Rowland, and Kristen Schock is just we couldn't ask for a better figurative-oriented 2D person, and David Meyer, and for a photography teacher, and
yeah,
Lucian Swordoff. I mean, he's an expert in his field, and all these people bringing these different expertises to the students. I mean, it's a very strong faculty.
Let's turn now to your story, Royal. Let's talk about your origins. The broad outline is that you grew up in San Francisco. You graduated from Brigham Young University, and then you studied painting in Europe. Tell us your story of how you came to be a painter, and start with growing up in San Francisco.
Well, I'm not sure that the environment, which was, we moved around a lot, and we were more in California than anywhere
else. What did your parents do?
My father's an industrial engineer, so he's an efficiency expert, so he was moving from corporation to corporation, solving problems. And I ended up in high school in Los Angeles area, but I really wanted to be an artist. You know, I got an award from the Bank of America when I was a senior, and everything kind of looked in that direction as far as I was concerned. You know, my parents were really negative about you can't make a living as an artist, etc. And so I decided I'd go to university and study psychology. Well, it morphed into an art degree anyway, and and I didn't feel I quite got what I wanted, and so all arrows seemed to point to my roots, my heritage in Scandinavia, and so I went to Oslo and got into, fortunately, into the art academy there.
It seems, from the outside, quite a leap to go from a four-year college in the Mountain West to Oslo.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, I think it was primarily because I had that, you know, I had actually most of the teachers at Brigham Young were Art Students League trained. Mm-hmm. In other words, they had that European background, and I could draw quite well. And when I entered, well, from my side of it, I really wanted very much to emulate and learn about Edvard Munch. And so there was no better place, I thought, than going to Oslo to do that.
Sure.
Fortunately, the entry into the Art Academy was based on a 3 days to make this drawing, and that was the whole ball of wax, so to speak. And I was one of the fortunate 30 out of 3,000 that was admitted. So at that point, I was going to stay around.
Yeah. This is After Deadline. Royal Nebaker is our guest today. Royal's been chairman of the Clatsop Community College Art Department, and he's a renowned artist, painter. Royal, it is. Let's go back to what your parents said about becoming an artist. And
okay.
It is widely assumed, by the rest of us at least, that it's tough to make a living as an artist. But you have. How do you make that work?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, where the landscape didn't match the map was when I got the chance, and I did this early on during college in the summers, to go to Europe. And it became, you know, more and more evident that in Europe, artists were considered a legitimate profession. And the attitude in Scandinavia, and I think throughout Europe, is that if you're properly trained, you know, it's very much like any other trade. You could be an electrician, or you could be a plumber, not just by saying, oh, I am an electrician, but because you went through the proper channels. And so these national art academies are usually necessary for people to have the credential to operate as an artist. But I saw there that this was a way, not necessarily, in the United States it always seems like, are you the starving artist or are you the rich and famous artist? Nothing in between. But in Europe, it's easy to just make a good living and be an artist. And so I think that's kind of what I tracked on. But I'll tell you one thing. When I left Europe, I was, you know, coming back after the society's support of artists in Europe, I was pretty devastated about how little support an artist would receive in the United States. And I think the best thing we do is that we allow artists to teach on the, you know, in the higher levels. Gives them an opportunity to have a steady income, train other artists, and at the same time have the freedom to do what they really want to do. I think that the servitude to the marketplace is almost more scary than taking another job as well as your career as an artist. So in the United States, most artists who are successful do some teaching to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm. Some years ago, you purchased a boat barn that's in the Columbia River off 31st Street, and you made it your studio. But the horrific storm of 2007 took the roof off that building, damaging a large number of your canvases. Have you recovered from that lost ground?
I can say definitively no. you haven't seen the third story put back up again, but we are making a lot of headway. And it, you know, it took a while just to clear out the rubble from the storm. And at this stage, we have a rubber roof on there, a temporary rubber roof, and so the building is staying dry, and I've had a structural engineer go through it and given us a good bill of health there as far as it makes sense to restore it. And so we've been making a lot of headway, putting some sway bracing in and different things. But the importance, I think, of this structure in our community, many of us are very attached to its historical presence. You know, it's really important to have something left from what Astoria has been.
But what, three of these left?
Also, you know, the other part, though, is it's getting progressively hard for artists to have creative spaces. Musicians, writers, painters, sculptors, you know, these kind of old working waterfront buildings are soon to be long in the past. And we, as a group of artists, were over at the West Mooring Basin, the red building, you know, prior to its gentrification. And that's been generally, that's kind of like, you know, Soho and the Pearl District in Portland. It's the old formula that artists can only hold on to the buildings until they get them to a certain point, and then they're kind of taken away from you. So I thought I better buy the thing so that that can't happen. And so I think that now the exciting thing is we formed a 501c3 foundation, and we are at this point feeling pretty positive about down the road getting this building into a position where it can house the arts. And so our foundation is called WARF, and it's about working artists on the waterfront.
Well, what you just said, Royal, sort of is a nice transition, I think, into the next thing I'd like to explore with you. Astoria has seen its visual arts activity explode in the past 20 years with new galleries and what seems to be a proliferation of artists who were in residence. Why did that happen?
It's been a lot of fun to be here and watch this happen. I'm sure that this area really attracts artists. I mean, this is a very beautiful place. When I first found out about a teaching job opening and happened to find myself in this area and I saw how beautiful it was, I sought that position. So I think that it does attract people with a developed sensitivity to aesthetics and to beauty. So that right there would be one thing. But the other point is that I would maybe give the Scandinavian heritage a little credit here, because the community at large understands and appreciates artistic expression. It's very clear, both music and drama and visual arts. You know, there's an unusual citizenry in this community that can understand and will support the arts. And I think it's a very almost always when we have these visiting artists come, they remark on how much support there is. With our last show, the Un Natural show, you couldn't get another person in the gallery. It was literally shoulder to shoulder. I mean, there must have been 300 people up there.
Gee. Yeah.
So what's happened is that it's kind of synergistically fed on itself.
Sure.
We've gotten better artists because we've welcomed them. And I think the economic benefits from this growth in arts is becoming abundantly obvious.
Well, you make an important point implicitly, Royal, is that no matter whether you're a writer or a painter or a photographer or an actor, without an audience, you, in a sense, aren't fully engaged in your trade, if you will, and audiences are important. And so are critics, I guess, or those who write about it. And you and I have talked about this over the years, and I'd like to invite you to talk about that. You know, when we've talked before, you've made the point to me that that art criticism is important.
Right, right. You know, the Oregon Arts Commission had town hall meetings all over the state to try to decide what was important, especially for the individual artists and individual writers, individual painters, individual potters, you know. And one of the things, first highest priority seemed to be that people are starting to struggle with a place to do it. They need space. But right close on the heels of that was critical evaluation. Because not being in a big city like New York or even San Francisco, it's sometimes hard to be noticed. And I think most artists were telling us that they wouldn't even mind having negative criticism as long as they could get some feedback about what they're doing by qualified evaluators. So one of the things the commission is working on is bringing people into our communities who have those kinds of expertises, who can speak about the visual arts or about a literary work and make an informed response. Because I think that artists do need that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in response to what you've said to me, and we've engaged Kathleen Strecker, our Coast Weekend editor, we're, as you know, looking for a couple of people in our region here who can write in an informed way about these topics. You know, you were talking earlier, Royal, about the artists who have come here, and as you were, I was reflecting on some of the personalities that I've observed over the years, you being a primary one, Richard Roland, of course, Harry Bennett.
Yeah.
And in a much more quiet way, Eric Weigart. Mm-hmm. And then Noel Thomas. And what's interesting to me is that each one of those names I just threw out are very clearly defined characters, personalities. Seeing them on the street or just, you know, in a gallery or whatever, it's not like you have to book an appointment to see these people or anything like that. And you're all around us here. It's really a different thing than you find, I think, in most towns of 10,000 or most counties of 35,000 people.
Would you say that they are the same type of people?
Same type of what?
Characters?
You mean they're all alike?
Yeah.
No.
That's what I've always thought. That the one thing about artists is they're very hard to type.
Oh, yeah. No, they're quite singular.
They might dress very differently, act very differently.
Yeah.
But they might also be fairly unique.
Yeah. No, they're quite singular, I think. And if I may say so, I think your particular talent is to communicate across the line. Some artists, I think, I get the sense they can only talk to themselves or to their peers. It's hard for them to communicate beyond that boundary, and I've always found you very interesting for that reason. You serve on the Oregon Arts Commission, and I believe that you're one of few artists to sit on the commission. Tell us about what the commission does.
Well, first of all, you know, how did I get involved with that? I think you're one of the people that put my name up.
But, I put you up.
But when the governor offered this appointment, I made it very clear that I was a visual artist and that I would have a bias. And I frankly wanted to let them know, forewarned, that I would have an agenda, and that it was to get more funds in the hands of the individual artist and on an emerging level too, not just on the higher levels. I talked about regional, you know, getting work out of the Portland area, getting funding into the geographic areas like our own, where we have traditionally not been as well funded, and we've been kind of underutilized as contributors to the arts of the state. But I'll tell you why I accepted the position is one reason. Gary Snyder, when he came up to the college a couple times to read
the poet
from San Francisco, and I got him in on the side at some soiree after one of his readings, and I said, "How do you do this thing?" How, because I knew that he lived up in a rural area up above Tahoe. In that area, and he travels internationally, works internationally, and I was a little concerned. This is when I first got here, been living in Europe, and I thought, how do I keep from getting in a side jetty? And he made it very clear. He said, it's every artist's responsibility to, first of all, participate in the highest level of a network that they can conceive of and participate in, and secondly, it's equally their responsibility to educate their community in their expertise in the arts. And so I've always felt that that's really behind. I mean, I am primarily a visual artist. I am not primarily an educator or primarily a commissioner. But as part of what the obligation I feel, I want to train other artists. I want to educate other people and communicate to my chosen community what I think quality is.
To follow up on what you just said, you're primarily an artist. How does your time break down? What percent of your life are you an artist? What percent are you an arts commissioner? What percent are you doing what we're doing now?
Boy, I really don't. I haven't tabulated those percentages, but
sure. Just roughly.
I have to say, first of all, 100% artist.
Okay.
In each function, I think I'm qualified to do those things because of my experience as an artist. But certainly the larger part of a week is spent in creative activity. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's important to not allow things to filter you off from from your vision as a creative person too. I mean, that's one of the things that the artists need to do in the society is to function in an independent way and not get pulled off.
Well, the point you made, Royal, about and Gary Snyder made it to you about communicating to the wider world, I guess you would say, I think is an enormously important one. And the epitome of this is Leonard Bernstein. You know, some of the academics, musicologists, poo-poo some of his works.
Right.
But in the first place, I would submit that 50 years from now, people will be singing Maria and will be staging West Side Story long after a lot of atonal music is dead. But at the same time, Bernstein had such an ability to reach out well beyond the concert hall.
Right.
And by doing so, he beckoned people into the concert hall.
And it isn't a compromise at all.
No, not at all.
And I think that's important to remember. I think that there's a rather sophomoric attitude about being so pristine that you can't lower yourself to communicate with your fellows, and that is absolutely the wrong direction. You have to be, as an artist, part of your job description is generosity. You have to share your vision with everyone. Mm-hmm. And I have noticed, especially in the United States, that most artists are lecturers. They come out of the academic field. They have the ability to build that verbal bridge, which seems to be important in our particular society and culture. We're not as visual as some other cultures, and so I almost feel it's a responsibility to be able to explain verbally at least a criteria for people to judge my work on.
Well, what's next for you, Royal? What's on your agenda, your schedule?
Well, I'm working right now for a show. We'll be in Seattle in the fall, and I've got some work already in Germany, and I'm adding some more work to that for a show in Berlin. I'm planning a trip to Scandinavia, working a little bit with the Art Academy on some project there that I graduated from.
When I interviewed Henk Pander on this show, it was interesting. He's Dutch, and that's where his training came from, and Rembrandt, you know, was in his heritage, if you will. And I've thought about that when you mentioned the American attitude, which is to say you got to serve the marketplace or starve, so to speak.
Right.
And we, of course, have quite a lineage here in this country by now, but we don't seem willing to accept that.
One thing that I'd like to go on record as saying about Hank's work, it compares favorably in paint quality, and that's a tough one, to Rembrandt. I mean, I can stand in front of a Rembrandt and come to tears looking at the beauty of the paint, and I really think that these are some kinds of things that often are only noticed by other artists, but I think that classical training was important for Hank. It certainly was for me.
Mm-hmm. Our guest today on After Deadline has been Royal Nebaker, artist who resides in Gearhart and has been chairman of the arts department of Clatsop Community College.